Tonight on Arena, Marco Rowe on a new live-streamed version of his play The Approach and celebrating the centenary of Patricia Highsmith, the creator of the talented Mr. Ripley. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Well, if ever a play was suited to the online days we're living through at the moment, I think The Approach by Marco Rowe certainly is suited to such a treatment. Deirdre Crotty and Aisling O'Sullivan play sisters Denise and Anna, with Kathy Belton as their friend Cora. None of them are as close as they used to be, and we find out why in the course of three conversations where they talk about the old days and catch up on the present. The Approach premiered at the Project Arts Centre in Dublin 2 years ago, and it's been revived for three performances only with the same cast to be live streamed this Thursday, Saturday and Sunday. And I'm delighted to say that writer and director Marco Rowe joins me now on the line. Good to speak with you, Mark. Did you know you had plans to revisit this play anyway? And the real hope was initially that it would actually happen in the theatre in a normal type of performance when the revival was first spoken about.
Absolutely, Sean. We were supposed to do it, I think, again in 2019, and we had some availability issues. And then we were going to do it again in 2020, and then we had other issues, and then, of course, COVID came along, and that put it to bed, just like it put so many other shows to bed as well. And then a few months ago, Anne Clark, the brilliant Anne Clark, actually came, I met up with her, she asked we could meet, and she had this idea to do a streaming version. And here we are, yeah.
Yeah, and when you started thinking about The Approach, I mean, essentially what we get are interlocking scenes, if you like, where we get two of the three characters speaking to each other at different points in time, and we get, you know, different versions of a story or the story told from another side. So you're drip feeding the information to us. When you thought about the form of the stage play itself, did it strike you that perhaps it had something in it that was particularly suited to the live stream format?
God, well, that, you know, first of all, it's a long time ago. You know, it's a few years ago now when I wrote it. So, you know, I wouldn't have been thinking about any of those kinds of things at all. I with that particular play, I kind of started with the shape of it and the structure of it without really knowing what was going to happen. I knew I wanted it to be three women, and I knew the actresses I wanted to be in it as well. But beyond that, I didn't know. And, you know, when we did it 2 years ago, you know, it was very successful and well received. But yeah, suddenly it's coming back to, it was a very strange experience. You know, it was 2 years after, so we were all 2 years older. So everyone had matured that little bit. And also we were living in a world that was just completely different to what it had been before. And a couple of the actors kept saying to me, this is the perfect time for this. This is the perfect time because it's about connection, or the desire to connect, but the inability to connect. And it's only gradually that I've come around myself to sort of agreeing with them. You know, I was quite resistant to the idea at first because of the fact that I think we can twist almost anything into you know, being the right thing for a particular situation or time. But it does genuinely feel that it very much is, you know.
But I guess there must have been times during rehearsals and when you looked at the script yourself, because you're directing this as well again this time, you know, when you looked at the script yourself, you must have seen lines in there that clearly 2-3 years ago you had no knowledge that we were going to be in the situation we were in. But how suddenly lines took on a new meaning that wasn't there before, perhaps, or wasn't it certainly intended at the time?
Well, so much of the meaning of the play changed, I think. Originally, I think it was an ever so slightly, I mean, I would hardly call it a cynical play, but maybe, yeah, a little bit more cynical than it is now, in that it was about, you know, if not people's inability to communicate, but the efforts that people make and the failure of those to communicate. But that was really about who we were as people. And what it's kind of become now is there's an element of that, but there's also an element of not being able to communicate full stop, because we can't see each other, because we're distanced from each other. And so all of that stuff really fed into how we approached it, you know.
I'm going to play a clip, and I think this is actually from the original production, so it may have changed slightly in terms of what you're doing for the streamed version, but we can talk about that afterwards. And it's a conversation that this is the very first of the scenes, in fact, I think. No, it's the second of the scenes, yeah. Cora, played by Kathy Belton, and Deirdre Crotty playing the character of Denise. I suppose what we do need to know is that Denise and Anna, played by Aisling O'Sullivan, Denise and Anna are sisters, and they haven't been talking for quite a while. There's been a bit of a falling out, and we find out about that as the play goes on. But here's the conversation that is taking place between Deirdre Crotty's character, Denise, and Kathy Belton, then the old friend, Cora.
I don't know. Whatever. I'm rabbiting on.
No, that's fine.
No, I am. Tell me something else about you.
Like what?
How's work?
Work's fine. I'm still in Corrigan's.
Right.
For my sins.
For your sins? It isn't that bad, is it? Actually, whatever happened to that one you were saying?
Fiona.
Was that her name?
Who used to be at me.
Yeah?
Fiona. Yeah, she left.
She left?
She's gone a couple of years now, actually.
Bitch. She was jealous of you, you know that?
Yeah. No, Anna said something similar.
Did she?
Hmm.
Well, there you go, you know. I mean, if two of us think it.
No, that's true.
So, what else?
What else? Bridie died.
She didn't die. When?
Fairly recently, actually.
Cora.
Hmm. I mean, she was very old now.
I know, but you must have been devastated, were you?
Devastated enough, yeah.
God. I'm sorry to hear that, darling.
Listen, she was a dog.
Still, though?
No, I know.
And come here, would you and Anna see each other a lot, so?
A little bit of black humour is always present in the plays of Marco Rowan, certainly, when we get a little bit upset about Bridie. I know the loss of a pet is a sad thing in anybody's life. I've experienced it myself, so I'm not laughing at it. But it kind of you are poking a little bit of fun, are you, Mark? Or am I putting emotions into your play that aren't there?
Well, I hate to disagree with you, Sean, but actually, no, it's in fact, you know, Cora is quite a solitary character. Mm. So although the conversation at the time that we hear it, which is early enough in the play, is quite, you know, humorous and inconsequential. In fact, we slowly discover, you know, as we go along, Cora's solitude. So in a way, the idea of this pet that she had in her life being sort of her only company or consolation becomes quite a big deal, you know.
So fellas like me who snigger when we see that earlier on feel awful when we hear some of the darknesses, yeah. Later on.
I suppose so, yeah.
that's the nature of playwriting, isn't it? In that original production, Mark, it was whichever of the two characters was there at the time sitting on a pretty blank stage, round, kind of just a big light lighting them almost in a circle either side of the table. And then a new character came in for the second scene, etc. You know, only two on stage at any one time. What happens then for this live streamed version? Will the three actors be in the same place talking to each other, or will it be a technical live streaming? Will they be in different places?
It's a great question, Sean. We've been allowed to have them in the same place because there's only two in any scene. Mm. At any given time. We've had to double, I think, the width of the table that they sit at, so that there's a 2 metre distance between them, which I think works very well, actually. But then the great thing about doing it for a live stream is that, you know, you can hear from the clip there that the play is a very kind of quiet, intimate, subtle piece, and you want the interplay between the actors to be as natural as possible. And when you do it with a proper live audience, you know you've got to take care of those technical things like projecting to the back of the to the back row of the audience, and facing that little bit more out to the audience. You're sort of sharing the play with them, etc. But with a live stream, you can bring the cameras right in, like in a TV drama or a movie, and so that means that our whole rehearsal process this time around has been quite different, and it's been about minimizing and modulating and just making things much more nuanced and subtle, kind of constantly shifting, because we know that the camera is in there and we can be really close kind of watching them. So that's kind of been an amazing experience. That's been the best part of the whole, you know, revisiting it for live streaming.
Yeah, because even again in that clip when Kathy Belton's character mentions Anna, the Aisling O'Sullivan character, who is the sister of Denise, the Deirdre Crotty character, Dervla's character says something very almost inconsequential. Oh, I say, and you think, yeah, it's what she's not saying there that's actually way more important than what she's saying. And I guess you can really pick up on those subtleties then when the camera can go in close.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's been amazing to kind of watch that happen because they really, you know, I felt the performances were absolutely fantastic first time round, but they've just gone much, much, much deeper this time round, and that's been incredibly exciting to watch. You know, and the play itself, of course, is, you know, on the surface, all it is three conversations, which for the most part feel quite friendly and inconsequential, and they're just chatting. But the actual real story of the play is in all those subtleties and in all those things that aren't being said. So we find that, you know, as each scene kind of slightly contradicts another scene, we begin to work out what's actually really happened in the play, which ends up being very high stakes and dramatic, you know.
And the importance of the live stream aspect of this, because obviously if it was a television play or a television production, you could actually do all those cutaways and do all those things separately. You could even do it in the theatre if you wanted and stitch it all together subsequent to the event. But what was the attraction of actually having it as a live stream so that it is happening live in front of those who are logged on to watch?
Well, the first thing, it's a slightly smaller thing, Sean, is that it's not really a play unless it's happening live. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, one great thing with the play is, you know, whether live or recorded, it's happening from start to finish in real time. You know, they don't get five takes and, you know, the chance to edit scenes together. They have to do the thing right through. And the only thing I can say about it is we did a practice live stream last Wednesday, and I went out of the room and I sat on my laptop with my you know, earphones in, and you did feel that, you know, there were several producers watching it, but obviously because of COVID, people were watching it in different places and locations. And you do get a really odd feeling of connection, even though you're sitting there on your own. I think it's because you're focusing so intently on this thing, watching it happen live. You also have this sense, even though people aren't beside you, but that there's some kind of digital connection happening from, you know, your room to somebody else's room to another country to whatever, that makes it feel really kind of electric and immediate. At least that's how it affected me.
Yeah, well, I must say that communal aspect of the theatre, I suppose, which is what we're all yearning to get back to, I have found in the live stream situation, you can't press, you know, the space bar and say, I'll go over and I'll put on the kettle and make a cup of coffee and I'll come back in a minute, you know, and watch the rest of it then.
Yeah.
You have to be there and watch it. If there's an interval as part of the show, fine, you can take your interval and have your cup of tea then or whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
you do actually maybe have to, as an audience member or as a viewer, you possibly have to put more in than you have to do in the you know, the recorded version.
It's a great point. I mean, I'm completely guilty of that kind of thing anyway. Do you know what I mean? Our attention spans have become so short or so distracted that we're constantly watching things in tiny little increments, do you know? And with the play, you're right, you can't pause it, you got to go right through. It's interesting, you know, a couple of people, family members or friends that I've been telling about it, any with kids, I've kind of said, if you're watching it, find a space that, or get rid of the kids somehow, or find a space that you're not going to be interrupted, because, you know, it really needs you to pay close attention, and, you know, pays huge dividends, obviously, but it's not one for, you know, watching in bite-sized chunks.
Yeah. What about lockdown and 2020 in general? How has it been for you, Mark?
It's been fine. I mean, you know, I suppose it's been tough for everyone. I suppose mine has been easier than some and more difficult than others. I have found that creatively, I'm very interested in people's creativity over this period, you know, because at the beginning, there was that thing, wasn't there, where everyone was saying, this is the time now, we'll all create our masterpieces. There's nothing to do but kind of be creative. But I've been working on a few little bits and pieces, rewriting pre-existing scripts for TV and stuff like that. So that's kind of kept me going sort of financially. But I found it much more difficult to do any sort of real personal creative work. I thought about this a lot, and I think it's because we can't quite see the future yet. Do you know what I mean? So there's no kind of way to plan anything in our heads. So when we write something, we're kind of writing in a vacuum, and we, you know, with no hope of having any kind of defined date that anybody can see it. Kind of creates a little bit of a sort of low level anxiety. It does for me anyway. But it's done okay, you know. Yeah, it's great. Yeah, it's great to be doing this.
So. And again, it's writers that have said this to me almost more so than any other art form. And it's kind of surprising because I've said it before. The cliche is the writer puts him herself or herself way up into the attic beside their desk, and they enjoy the isolation. They can get on with things. But I suppose it is only isolation if you're avoiding loads of outside activity, which you just can't do at the moment.
Very true, very true. Well, look, I write in cafes, I always have, so that's one thing that I haven't been able to do. So just the idea of, for me, it's about getting used to the isolation and the quiet and you know, trying not to go downstairs and watch TV or, you know, do any of those other distractions, eat or, you know. So I can't wait for things to get back to normal. Yeah,
you're not alone in not being able to wait for things to get back to normal. If you had to hazard a guess, when do you think it's realistic to be thinking about getting back to theatres, Mark?
Oh, don't ask me, because I'm so pessimistic about this stuff. For me, the big fear is, you know, as a playwright, not wanting to be, you know, one of two things is going to happen, right? We open the theatres and people are going to trickle back really, really, really slowly because they're still quite scared. Mm. Or else people are just going to kind of come back en masse. And it's quite tough. You know, it would be quite tough to be one of the playwrights at the vanguard kind of risking empty theatres because people aren't quite ready to come back yet, you know. But I, you know, if I was to hazard a guess, I'd say definitely after summer, maybe autumn, something like that.
Yeah, it'd be good if we could have something resembling a theatre festival that involved going to the theatre this year. Wouldn't that be something to look forward to? Well, listen, in the meantime, great to speak to you, Mark, and continued whatever type of creativity you're having. I hope it continues at whatever level you can have it continue at until the current situation passes by. But in the meantime, Mark O'Rourke speaking to us there about his play, The Approach. It will be live streamed 21st, 23rd and 24th. That's Thursday, Saturday and Sunday. And you can get further details about all of that on theapproach.ie. Yeah, Up the Flats there from Gemma Dunleavy. And Gemma has been revealed as one of the 10 acts chosen by RT2FM for its 2FM Rising List for 2021. For Those I Love, Shiv, The Clockwork, Shane Codd, Leah Hart, Monjola, Robert Grace, Bobby Arlo, Plantain Pappy and Gemma, all set to be championed on 2FM over the next 12 months. Lots of music from them to be aired on the station and interviews as well. And each act will receive a €1,000 bursary from IMRO, the Irish Music Organisation. And Gemma's track that we just heard there, Up the Flats, from her debut EP of the same name. Who is the most quoted writer in popular discourse? Shakespeare? Oscar Wilde? Or what about the guy being paraphrased here by Donald Tusk when, as president of the European Council, he criticised the instigators of Brexit?
We will not gamble with peace or put a sell-by date on reconciliation. And this is why we insist on the backstop. I've been wondering what that special place in hell looks like for those who promoted Brexit without even a sketch of a plan how to carry it safely.
Special place in hell. The politician Donald Tusk, the artist Sandro Botticelli, later William Blake, Auguste Rodin, Salvador Dali and James Joyce, all inspired by the work of the Italian writer Dante, who created the Divine Comedy some 700 years ago. The Divine Comedy gives us a vision of heaven, hell and purgatory that has seared into the collective imagination. And we've asked Trinity College's Enrica Maria Ferrara to bring us through the work and to show us why it's such a seminal piece of writing. Enrique, Dante, or Dante Alighieri, as we can call him, born in Florence in the 13th century. We know the great love was Beatrice. We know about his trip to hell, heaven and purgatory that you're going to tell us more about. But the man behind all of that, a soldier, a civil servant, what type of person are we talking about?
Yes, he was. Thank you, Sean. Yes, he was a soldier. He was a civil servant. He held quite a few political offices. But in reality, what he really was and he wanted to do was to be a poet and to study philosophy. He was a great poet and a great philosopher. And you mentioned Beatrice, the love of his life. He met her when he was only 9. And then he met her again when he was 18. And that love sparked. This was the kind of platonic love and spiritual love. And in fact, she becomes his guide in the Divine Comedy. She symbolizes poetic salvation and grace in the Divine Comedy. She died very young in childbirth, in 1290. So she was dead, in fact, at the time when he portrayed her in the Divine Comedy.
You mentioned he met her when he was 9 and then again at 18. That 9, we'll find, is very important indeed. So the Divine Comedy then, if I refer to it as an epic poem, am I using a correct term there in that we have this hero, I guess, in Dante heading off on this journey, quite a set of places he's sending himself to?
Yes, absolutely. You can define him. You can define it an epic poem in the same way that the Iliad and the Odyssey by Homer, or the Aeneid by Virgil, they were epic poems. And the main thing about this poem to be defined as epic for me is its theatricality. So, like, it is a very theatrical poem. Originally, epic poems were oral poems that were sung by bards, used metric forms and scheme to memorize them. And this is a particularly revolutionary piece of work, you know, like from Dante, because Dante wrote this work in the vernacular. And vernacular, you know, like was the language that actually was Italian, Florentine based, you know, at the time. And so it was very easily memorized. And in fact, it was among the common people that was very popular, the comedy, you know, was an oral tale before becoming, you know, like the written author. Poem, you know, like that became.
Yeah, so that, I'm interested in that oral aspect of that you're talking about there, and the fact that it was kind of a tale of the common people. So, did he write it then in a Florentine dialect, or was it put into a courtly type of Italian later on, or did it remain in that dialect?
No, it was written in that dialect. It was written in the Florentine dialect, in the vulgar, in the vernacular, you know, if you wonder, this is how it was called. But at the same time, it was also a plurilinguist language. You know, it was a language full of Latinism. It was a language full of open to other dialects and to other cultures. So it was exactly, you know, it was a language of the people, but with a refined touch, you know, like it was a refined slant. And this is one of the reasons why the Divine Comedy, I think, is so very good, so apt to be recited aloud. You have so many examples of podcasts, for example, online for the Divine Comedy. And there is a podcast, an audiobook that has been produced this year for the 700th anniversary in 33 languages, would you believe? And it will be presented at the Italian Culture Institute on the 25th of March.
Well, let's get a sense then of the type of journey that he goes on. How important is the time that he, because he's heading there, it's Dante himself in Easter week of 1300 who's heading off on this journey. That's a very contemporary take on it, I suppose, for the readership and the audience of the day. Mm. How important is that? How important is the Easter week aspect of the setting and time?
So it's the Easter week. So like it was the 1300 was a year of the Jubilee. So like it was a religious time. It was a religious occasion to repent, you know, like from your own sin and kind of acquire salvation for the purgatory souls. But at the same time, the 1300 is a very, very important year for the political history of Florence and for the personal history of Dante, because Dante was a member of the White Guelphs, and the White Guelphs and the Black Guelphs were contending Florence. They were engaging in a very bloodthirsty battle at the time. And Dante, as a result of this battle in 1302, was exiled from Florence. And this is very important, you know, like for the future, you know, for his writing on the Divine Comedy, because the fact that then he wrote the comedy and started writing the comedy in 1306, allowed him by setting it in the 1300 to have a retrospective look on what had already happened. So the character Dante in the comedy became a sort of prophet of events that had already happened at the time of writing. And this also allowed him to throw in hell some of his enemies, so the people that he considered responsible for his exile and he deemed responsible for the moral corruption and violence that were tearing his homeland apart. So the fact, the very interesting thing is that it's probably the first work of literature in which the personal and the political dimensions are one thing.
I get the impression from what you're saying there that it was a very political poem then in its day, speaking directly to those that Dante wanted to hit back at. And it's the nine, we're at that figure as well, the nine circles of hell.
Yes.
You don't want to be too far down those circles, do you? It's quite a horrific vision that he gives us.
It's an horrific vision that he gives us, you know, like it's very much ties in with the religious, belief, you know, like of the time, the hell, the purgatory, and the nine circles, you know, like the further down you go into the circle of hell in this like funnel-shaped inverted cone that is the crater of Inferno, and the further down, you know, like the more wicked are the sins, you know, they are punished in those lower circles. So in the first circle, so you are punished for sins of incontinence, so you're not able to resist your passions and you're not able to resist, you know, the lure of your sins. So it's lust, it's gluttony, it's greed. And then, like, the farther down you go, like, you have the more wicked sin there, the sin of violence, violence against others, violence against God, and violence against nature. So the blasphemous, the sodomites, and the murderers. And then, like, the farther down again in the eighth circle and the ninth circle, the sinners who are who commit fraud and malice, you know, like sins linked to fraud and malice are punished there. So you have, I mean, like there is a huge, you know, like a long list, you know, like you have pimps and seducers and flatterers and simoniacs, who are those who sold church favors and offices. And then you have the barristers, who corrupt politicians. You have hypocrites, thieves, and false counselors. And there's all sort of terrible and horrific punishments that Dante imagines for this.
Corrupt politicians end up in Circle 8 of hell, along with thieves and false counsellors. Who's down below that then?
False counsellors, you know, one famous, apart from the Brexiteers, you know, like one famous false counsellors that is down there is Ulysses.
Yeah.
And Ulysses is punished for the trick of the Trojan horse and other terrible sins like this. And the one particular sin, that is the fact that he convinces his crew to sail across the Pillar of Hercules and die in shipwreck. He had, if you want to call it, the gift of the gab. So he convinced, you know, his crew to go to death, you know, to their death, because the world ended at the end of the Pillars of Hercules. But those verses are, I think, were some of the best examples of Dante's the verse in the Divine Comedy.
Yeah, but there is a lower level than level 8, level 9. These are the causers of division. Who was
Yes.
And I presume this was a direct comment on the society he was writing in.
Yes, the causes of division, definitely, you know, like those that were causing discord and conflict in society and politics. So it was those, you know, like that he wanted to hit. And for example, down there is Bertrand de Born, who caused the conflict between Henry II of England and his son. And so he was beheaded. And his punishment is that he has to carry around his head severed from his body. He's, in fact, you know, like this happened according to the law of contrapasso, which is like the law that Dante defined and devised, you know, like for assigning the sins, you know, counter penalty.
Kind of a karma idea that whatever you did bad on earth, you'll get some version of that down below.
Absolutely. An eye for an eye, you know, like that kind of thing, you know, like so the punishment is devised, you know, like a sort of karma or poetic justice. Yeah. So they either resemble the sin or in contrast with the sin. But, you know, like they really are horrific.
Give me an example of one of the most salaciously, deliciously horrific punishments.
Me, you know, like, the boiling river of blood for the murderers is terrible, but also the flatterers have to sink in their own excrement, you know, which is like pretty bad, I suppose. You know, like the barristers, so like the politicians, the corrupt politicians, have to be immersed in boiling tar. That is a reference to corrupt and shady and sticky deals, and others. You know, like there's like this. People turning into snakes, yeah. and the falsifiers and imposters suffer terrible disease like leprosy, rabies, dropsy, and stinking fever. Yeah. There's a thing called stinking fever. It's not the coronavirus, but it's something.
So hell is a pretty horrific sense. Place, and fire is everywhere. There's fire all over the place, but not when we get to Lucifer himself.
No. No, exactly. And there is a frozen lake, and the fact that there is ice down there is significant because it is a symbol of the, you know, the fact that the cold blood and the hatred that defines the traitors. The traitors are the ones that are down there in the ninth circle of hell. And Lucifer is trapped in the ice from his waist down and has three faces of three different colors. And these three faces munch and gnaws the highest traitors of humanity and God. So these are Brutus and Cassius, who are those who killed Julius Caesar, and of course Judas, the apostle, you know, betrayed Christ. Yeah.
So obviously hell is the place you want to avoid. I should say that Dante doesn't go off on this journey all by himself. He has Beatrice with him. Who else is with him?
Virgil is there. Virgil is a Latin poet, and who's there? And, you know, Virgil would not be allowed actually to go through either hell or, you know, like he's actually stuck in limbo. He's an unchristian. So he's stuck in limbo, but he's given a special dispensation to accompany Dante. And then there is Beatrice, of course, in Paradiso, in paradise. And yes, you know, these are the guides, you know, like that they are taking him through his journey.
But I wonder then to what extent, you know, are the trips to purgatory and the trip to paradise, are they as colourful as the wonderful nature of the trips to hell, the nine circles of hell? The number nine continues to be important, isn't it? Seven balconies we have in purgatory and two kind of annexes or whatever that add up to nine again.
Yes, so it's still nine levels, you know, if you want to call them, you know, with the anti-purgatory, and then like you have like the seven terraces corresponding to the seven deadly sins, and then you have the earthly paradise on the top. It is, would you believe that Joyce and Beckett considered purgatory the best of the three worlds? Because it was a place that it was like more resembling life, while hell was so extreme and paradise was so extreme in the other way. Mm. So I personally think that purgatory is a beautiful, gives us beautiful examples of the journey.
And is it the case then in purgatory that those who are on the balconies or in whatever the anterooms, that they're learning their lessons here and eventually they'll get it right and they can proceed up to the higher level?
Exactly. So like there's a better atmosphere in the sense, you know, like in the purgatory, because like, you know, that your soul will be saved. So like, you will be cleansed, you know, like, and it doesn't matter what, you'll be saved in the universal judgment or whatever it is. But apart from the fact that, you know, you have an actual penance to endure, for example, the proud have to carry a huge stone or the envious have to have their eyes shut with wire. You have also examples of the consequences of sin and examples of the virtue that you have to pursue, that they are either engraved on the terraces or they come to you in the shape of voices and stories that are told. So it is very interesting the way also Dante uses art in a sense, you know, like as a tool to enhance, you know, like yourself and cleanse your soul.
So art is seen not as a penance, but as a kind of a mode of teaching, is there, a mode of learning?
Yes, it's modern learning. Yes, it is. And it's a bit indoctrinating in a sense, you know, like as well, you know, like it is not, you know, it has to be a use, but at the same time, it's a cathartic tool, you know, like to elevate your soul.
Now, what about when we get into paradise then? Does it become too much of a good thing the higher up the circle as you go there? Or you're in spheres really when you get to paradise, aren't you? nine different spheres.
Yes, you are in spheres. You know, like, and you're well to remember that, of course, you know, this is a Ptolemaic and geocentric idea of the Earth. Mm. So, like, there are nine concentric and spheres, you know, like, they are all concentric, you know, like, all spaced, you know, like, around the Imperius. And this is where he wants to get, you know, like, obviously, Dante wants to get to God. Now, it gets a little bit too much in the sense that it is very challenging to describe the essence of God, mm. of course, you know, like, and it's also very challenging for Dante to describe the fact that he is getting to paradise with his whole body. So the whole purpose of his journey and the whole peculiarity of his journey, that he goes all the way through hell and purgatory and heaven with his flesh, in his flesh.
Right.
So yes, and there are very you know, poetic and beautiful verse in the Paradiso, but there's also a lot of doctrine, and there are many religious aspects. You know, you have to explain the religion and explain the love that emanates from God and makes all the spheres moving.
I mentioned some of the, you know, the influences and some of the various artists and writers that have been inspired by Dante down the ages. I mean, it's an endless list, really. But I'm wondering to what extent you started by telling us about this oral tradition and how, in fact, it has that vernacular quality in the writing. Does it still have a place in popular culture in Italy? And indeed, because it strikes me that around the world, it's really an academic study now rather than a kind of, it wouldn't be thought of as being rough and vernacular now, would it?
No, but we have a very famous comedian, that is Roberto Benigni, who is the director of La Dolce Vita. You probably remember The Beautiful mm-hmm. Life. You remember this movie that was very, very famous. And he has performed Dante, you know, like in a popularized version. And he actually goes on stage and recites the Commedia, making it relevant for the people. And this has been something that has been done in the last few years. But there is also so many examples of street art, and you have graffiti in the street, and you have comic books, but you also have video games inspired to Dante.
Oh,
there's a famous video game that was made in 2010, Inferno, and has Dante as a knight, as a Templar knight, and going through the different levels, you know, like in the different circles of hell, at the different levels of the game.
It's not all high flown art thought when it comes to Dante and the Divine Comedy. Listen, thanks so much for explaining some of that to us and opening up to us this evening, Enrica. That's Enrica Maria Ferrara. The Dante Public Lecture Series in Cork is organised by Dara O'Connell, features international scholars from all over the world. Starts on the 1st of February with Zig Baranski on Paradiso 24. That's the 24th book. And Enrica Maria Ferrara is the editor of Posthumanism in Italian Literature and Film, Boundaries and Identity. And that's published by Palgrave Macmillan, and it'll be launched at the end of this month. Tomorrow, January the 19th, marks what would have been the 100th birthday of one of America's greatest authors of psychological thrillers. Patricia Highsmith wrote 22 novels, many other short stories over her five-decade career, many of which have been adapted into hugely successful movies. These include Alfred Hitchcock's 1951 adaptation of Strangers on a Train, the 1999 film adaptation of The Talented Mr. Ripley, and more recently in 2015, the movie Carol with Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara. And this was an adaptation of Patricia Highsmith's novel The Price of Salt, which was subsequently reissued as Carolyn. There's a story there, we'll get that later on. Ripley, Andrew Scott, it has emerged, will star in a new television adaptation, a forthcoming Showtime series simply called Ripley, because there's a whole series of Ripley novels. So to look at the extraordinary career and literary output of Patricia Highsmith, I'm joined now by Dr. Claire Clark of the School of English at Trinity College in Dublin. Her background and her family life, her early, her childhood life, very interesting, and the relationship and difficult relationship with mother and stepfather at the very heart of her formation, Claire.
Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, when we read her novels, they're so dark. And then when we start to look at her biography, we understand why she had this crazy religious Confederate family. Her mother and birth father divorced a few days before she was born. He hadn't wanted her. her mother had tried to get rid of her and actually joked with her as a child about how she had tried to get rid of her by drinking turpentine and said, "Oh, Pat, it's so funny because you love the smell of turpentine." So this is a very dark family dynamic here, I think, which goes some way to explaining the kind of families that we see in her books then.
Yeah, hardly surprising then that in her first novel she had people out trying to murder family members. Let's have a listen to a clip, in fact, from the film adaptation, the Alfred Hitchcock film adaptation, and it kind of gives us the basic setup of the story of Strangers on a Train here. Farley Granger is playing Guy Haines, Robert Walker is Bruno Anthony, and they're trying to make a little arrangement with each other that might suit both of them.
Okay. Want to hear one of my ideas for a perfect murder?
I may be old-fashioned, but I thought murder was against the law.
What is a life for two guys? Some people are better off dead. I don't like your wife and my father, for instance. Oh, that reminds me of a wonderful idea I had once. I used to put myself to sleep at night, figuring it out. Let's say that you'd like to get rid of your wife.
It's a morbid thought.
No. Just suppose. Let's say that you had a very good reason.
Let's say.
Now, you'd be afraid to kill her. You know why? You'd get caught. And what would trip you up? The motive. Now, here's my idea.
I'm afraid I haven't got time to listen, Bruce.
Listen, it's so simple, too. Two fellows meet accidentally, like you and me. No connection between them at all. Never saw each other before. Each one has somebody that he'd like to get rid of. So, they swap murders.
Swap murders?
Each fellow does the other fellow's murder. Then there's nothing to connect them. Each one has murdered a total stranger. Like, you do my murder, I do yours.
There you go. The setup of Strangers on a Train, as seen in the 1951 Alfred Hitchcock adaptation of Patricia Highsmith's novel Strangers on a Train. Tomorrow would have been Patricia Highsmith's 100th birthday, and we're looking at her work this evening with Dr. Claire Clark. Claire, you mean it is such a simple setup, and it's ingenious when it's laid out in front of you like that. But and this was her debut novel. How long and how in the family that she grew up in, how did she make her way towards even writing that debut novel?
Well, I mean, it seems like she grew up in quite a cultured family in a lot of ways. Both of her parents, her mother and her adoptive father, were illustrators. And she certainly grew up surrounded by books. She went to a good high school in New York. She lived in Manhattan, and she ended up going to Barnard College. So it seems like she was reading Poe, she was reading Stevenson, Conan Doyle, Bram Stoker, all of these kind of dark authors, were part of her childhood. And then she seems to have started to write when she actually was at high school. And I think it's quite fun. Her first story she wrote when she was 16 is called Crime Begins. And it's a story of a 16-year-old girl who steals a library book from her school library and gets away with it. And she was thinking of a particularly hard-to-get history book from her own school library, which had a waiting list of 150 girls in front of her. So she was kind of always interested in this idea of getting away with things. Ordinary people could.
Yeah, rather innocent, mind you, the library book in comparison to some of the setups that she gives us. Ripley, then, there were a whole series, obviously the probably best known, particularly the film, The Talented Mr. Ripley, Matt Damon, Gwyneth Paltrow and Jude Law, huge success in 1999. But there was a whole series of Ripley novels.
Yes, I mean, he stars in a series of novels. She seems to have not been able to get away from him throughout her life. You know, well, sometimes when we think about sequels, we think about somebody banging out books kind of, one after the other. But there were long gaps between this series. So he was obviously a character, I think, that she felt attuned to and drawn back to. And we know this because she does things like sign some of her letters, Pat, or alias Ripley. We also
know give us a sense of the character of Ripley then, and what you think in his character might transfer directly into Pat, alias Ripley. You know, the parallels with Highsmith herself.
Yeah, I think like Ripley is so similar to her in a lot of ways, because he's embarrassed by the kind of gaucheness of American life, and he's not very wealthy, but he feels like he deserves something better. And that's certainly something that she felt. And she then moved to Europe, as does Ripley, where he feels he can really kind of immerse himself in the cultured world of old Europe and go to galleries and look at beautiful architecture and so on. And how he does this is by killing somebody who has a lot more money but a lot less class than him, and taking over his identity. So he feels like money is the thing that's holding him back from having this life. But I think, you know, he's such an interesting character, because she shows us his psyche through the books. You know, we don't see him just from the outside. We see the ways in which he wants to be loved and he wants to be liked. So the guy that he kills in The Talented Mr. Ripley, Dickie Greenleaf, he desperately wants Dickie to love him and to admire him, possibly as a friend, possibly as more.
Yeah.
When the rejection that he feels when Dickie is not really interested is devastating. And I think these are the types of things that Highsmith herself felt, particularly in relationship to her family.
The Price of Salt is an interesting novel and an interesting story around it, in that that was its original publication name, but it was subsequently published as Carol. And then in 2015, that was the movie that we got. This is the story of a same-sex relationship. How daring was this in 1952? And what did she do that was so different from what might have been there in other same-sex stories that people were reading at the time?
I mean, it's incredibly daring. You know, as she said herself, in the gay literature of the time, there was no happy endings. There was no romantic success as such. So if you had gay men or gay women depicted in literature, in American novels, they had to pay for that in some way or other. So usually what happened was that they died at the end of the novel, either by suicide or by accident, or by kind of confining themselves to a life of heterosexuality and being deeply unhappy. Whereas what she does here is, you know, I've spoken about how she lets her criminal characters get away with things. Well, she lets her lesbian characters get away with things here, and what they get away with is being together and being happy. So it's incredibly groundbreaking for the time, but obviously the fact that she published under a pseudonym shows that she wasn't ready to be associated with that kind of celebration of openly gay love either. I mean, she was somebody who slept with women herself, but wasn't very happy about that, you know, wasn't at peace with that idea.
But she did subsequently publish the novel under the title Carol, with her own name on that novel, wasn't
yes.
it? Yeah, yeah.
So she did. So that was 1990.
Yeah,
so
quite a distance
into the future. A very different world, I think, that novel came into. But people still kind of say that that's the novel that outed Highsmith.
Yeah. How difficult, you know, a life did she have in terms of abuse of alcohol and depression?
She wasn't a happy person. I think she was definitely a very tortured person. And, you know, when you read her biographies, you read about her struggling with rage, struggling with depression, drinking every day, kind of starting the day with a bottle of gin, ending the day with a bottle of whiskey. I watched an interview with her this afternoon, actually, on YouTube, from the 70s, and she's there smoking Galois the whole time and swilling whiskey, and she doesn't crack a smile the entire time. She's very dry, she's very closed off, and she actually talks about the fact that she never wanted a family, never really wanted love, because she didn't feel she was capable of it. She didn't have good role models in that way, and she just wanted to be by herself, essentially.
She didn't want to be totally by herself. She had her snails.
Well, she did have her snails, that's true.
Explain that.
Well, this is something that comes up, you know, in her biographies, which is hilarious, I think, that she's described as an animal lover, but the animals that she loved most were snails. And in fact, what she did, apparently, when she was in the kind of New York literary scene, she carried one of those huge kind of 1950s handbags, which had a head of lettuce and 100 snails inside. And she took this to parties with her and said that, you know, if she got bored, she could hang out with her friends the snails.
and good luck to any handbag snatcher that attempted to take the handbag off her.
Indeed, yeah.
Well, listen, very interesting to hear about her life and her work. That's Dr. Claire Clark there of the School of English at Trinity College in Dublin speaking to me about the career and legacy of the American thriller writer Patricia Highsmith, born on January the 19th, 1921, so would have been 100 years old tomorrow. And we'll keep our eyes and ears for the details about Showtime, that television series which is simply called Ripley, going to feature Andrew Scott in the title role. But that is our lot for this evening here on Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Dunn was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.